underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester Center, Vermont, and Saratoga Springs, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a new Bachelor of Science degree in Public Health with a focus on social, physical, and behavioral sciences. strose.edu.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Colum Tabeen is the author of seven novels, including The Master, Brooklyn, The Testament of Mary, and Nora Webster, as well as two story collections. His latest novel is House of Names. The book is his reimagining of one of the most famous Greek tragedies, a powerful king who sacrifices his daughter to the gods, a vengeful wife who then murders him, their children who in turn kill their mother. It is the story of Agamemnon, Clytemnestra, Iphigenia, Orestes. Again, the name of the new novel is House of Names, before a live audience at the White Hart Inn in Salisbury, Connecticut, presented by Oblong Books and Music. It is a pleasure to welcome Colum Tabeen to this week's book show. I was so worried I was going to screw up one of these Greek names.
You're doing very well.
Thank you very much. Quite frankly, I was afraid to screw up your name.
No, my name is not Greek, but I know what you mean.
There is a pronouncer on the internet that tells you how to pronounce your name, and I defy anyone to watch that and actually pronounce it correctly.
Yeah, Tobin, as in has been.
At what point did you come to this? I mean, this is obviously a famous Greek tragedy. How did you first come to it?
I knew the story of Electra and her rage against her mother and her urge to have revenge against her mother. And I'd seen that performed a number of times. I had read the various versions of it. But all the time, new translations are coming, especially at the moment by someone like Anne Carson. And I noticed the mention of a play that I had never read called Iphigenia in Aulis. And when I read it, it was told from the mother, Clytemnestra's point of view, rather than Electra's point of view. And when I read that, it's a complex and interesting play because it tells you why the mother was motivated to kill her husband, Agamemnon, when he returned from the wars, that she was lured to the camp where he told her that their daughter, you can pronounce in various ways, Iphigenia, Iphigenia, whatever way you want to pronounce her name, that she was going to marry the warrior Achilles. And so the mother got all the seamstresses ready and they came with all their people for a wedding. But the father didn't tell her that in fact she was to be sacrificed because the gods said that the winds could not change unless she was killed. So, and he doesn't even have the courage to tell her when she arrives what it is he has in store for their daughter. So when I read that, I thought, I could work with that. Because I could work with the whole arrival, the expectation from her voice, just if she was the only one to speak, if it wasn't a play, if it was a monologue, that I could give her all the motives, what she thought, how she found out. When she meets Achilles, she says to him, well, I'm going to be your mother-in-law. And he says, what? So I'm going to be your mother-in-law, you know, smile. And he says, what are you talking about? Do you really not know why you're here? And she didn't. And then when she does, she realizes the humiliation. It isn't merely, you know, it's that he has fully humiliated her. And then she does everything to stop the event taking place, the sacrifice. She fails to do that. And what she decides to do then, when she goes home, is that if her husband, Agamemnon, should come home victorious from these wars, she will be ready for him. She will get him, and she will in turn murder him. So this spiral of violence will begin. And once I thought of all this, I realized that actually that's a story. Of course, when that was done, it wasn't enough. That the story then of that she in turn gets murdered by her son, Orestes, I had to set that up. I had to get Orestes as a child. I had to show you the development of this figure of Orestes so that the murder of his own mother would be credible in the book.
One of the things that I find fascinating is because you start with the story of Clytemnestra, and as we read her telling, so there's alternating points of view throughout the novel, we start out with her point of view, and it was alarming to me, not alarming, but I was interested from the very beginning because you think of, oh, she's writing about her husband, but I always knew him as the hero.
Yeah.
And this is not a hero the way she's describing him right now.
Yeah, one of the things about the novel form as it developed from the 18th century is it's not good with heroes. It's good with flaws. It's good with chancers. It's good with people who fail at things. And so therefore, to make him a hero, or indeed to make Orestes, their son, a sort of hero, really is something the novel won't absorb easily. It's much better if he's weak. For example, if he knows that he really shouldn't murder his daughter or kill his daughter, but he knows he's going to, and she watches him, first of all, afraid to tell her, and secondly, afraid of his own troops. She has utter contempt for the sort of weakness in him. But then we feel that she is fully justified, or at least we're meant to feel that, and then slowly you see her becoming a sort of monstrous figure, which again is something the novel can deal with, a slow change in somebody. So I was more interested in weakness, and the other thing that's very important, the novel is not good with the divine. The novel is essentially a secular space. If you just think about Jane Austen, for example, if you imagined Mr. Darcy praying to God the night before and God giving him a horse in the morning, and him going over to propose to Elizabeth and her praying through the night, and Lady Catherine de Bourgh, you know, like you just feel, no, I actually want being, you know, because she had disobeyed the gods, Lady Catherine de Bourgh being sort of treated like that in the novel. I mean, the novel is much better at human decisions, at humans facing their destiny, at agency, at choices, at chances. So really, by very early on in this book, I had to get rid of the gods. Part of the problem with the Greek gods is some of their names are very long or very short, with too many consonants or too many vowel sounds. And you just feel this will get in the way of every moment of this book. If I have to say the next morning when she woke up, she appealed to God this and God that. No. The next morning she woke up, she decided what she would do next. And that is something, again, the novel is easier with.
So it becomes almost an inner spirit as opposed to an outside influence.
Yeah, it becomes human agency rather than the result of prayer.
So as the novelist, in writing that, how did you overcome the removal of the gods and what is so often a very essential ingredient in those stories?
Well, in other words, once I did that, it released me to then work out the slow, meticulous planning for his murder that she organizes, which if she has to appeal to the gods, she doesn't have to do. So she has to work out slowly, how are you gonna lure your husband, victorious from the wars, into a room, get him on his own, in that moment where I think men are at their most vulnerable, where you have one foot in the bath and the other foot you're about to put into the bath. You know, and she gets him at that moment and puts a net around him. But if she's not planning, and she takes a lover, so that there'll be someone to help her. And of course, she makes a mistake in taking the lover. You know, she has to. But if she merely appeals to the gods and they say yes or no, then there's no reason why the reader should turn the next page.
Mm.
And I mean, obviously in the Greek theater, the enacting and reenacting of these stories had an almost religious power in the same way as we would say, for example, feel about the Mass, if you're a Catholic. But this is a novel, it's not a religious form. And therefore, I want the reader to turn the page saying, will she or will she not succeed in the plan she has so meticulously put together?
Did you learn early as a writer that the novel is not a religious form, that you did not have to stick with these very strict structures, that you had great freedom?
I suppose some of this comes from teaching, where you're trying to work out with students what's actually going on here. And that somebody like Henry James, who came out of a sort of New England tradition where there was a great deal of religious feeling, manages to give a character like Isabel Archer so much spiritual yearning on one side that she wants something rich from the world, which is not easy to name. It's not as though she wants money, or she doesn't want rank, for example, in James's novel Portrait of a Lady. But at the same time, she doesn't pray. It isn't as though she appeals to God at any point. I mean, there is a moment where they go into St. Peter's in Rome, which is odd because they're not Catholics. But nonetheless, the novel, James's novel, Portrait of a Lady, if you study it closely, is both a spiritual novel in some way, but a secular novel in another. And so just in formulating that with students and trying to work out the ambiguities and the distinctions, it helped me enormously to work out my own sort of procedures as a novelist.
Colm Tabin's new novel is House of Names. It is published by Scribner. So in writing the reimagining of this Greek tragedy, a story that has been told so often, was there a definitive text for you to look at, to use as the blueprint, if you will?
I suppose I used that late play by Euripides called Iphigenia in Aulis, and then the various versions of Electra. But for the character of Orestes, I had nothing to go on. For example, Electra is waiting for her brother to come back in order to deal with her mother. Where is he? No Greek scholar could tell me, and it's in no Greek text. He's obviously somewhere away. Now, in certain ways, that's a gift to a novelist, where since you have nothing to go on, you can start imagining things. So I imagine that his mother has sent him away because she wants to murder his father. And as you would do, you know, she doesn't want him in the house for that. You know, because he's an adolescent, she just thinks, get the children, not in front of the children, you know. And but of course her lover manages to have him kidnapped. And he's kidnapped and taken to a place where other boys of his age have been kidnapped. And with that, I met somebody from home, from Ireland, who was in the same school, in the same Catholic boarding school as me, who had just read the book and said, I see you finally put our boarding school into your book, you know, so that I could use something that I knew. That I could put that into the book as well. But what I want to do with this character of Orestes is build somebody who is not only not heroic, but he's easily led. He has no strategy, he has no plans. Somebody is always telling him what to do and he follows. There's an inner thug in him. There's a little boy who loves sword fighting. There's an adolescent who has a propensity for violence. There's a young man who will murder his own mother. But it's all a form of weakness. It doesn't come from a single heroism in him. It comes from a set of fears or a set of absences in him. He's the young man, or he's the boy whose father was away at war for so long. He didn't have a father. He's the boy who was kidnapped. So that what I need to do is to build him so slowly that you will realize that he is in the end, and it's a phrase used in the book, capable of anything. Mm-hmm. The problem I have then is that in the last section of Aeschylus, of the Oresteia, the Furies come after him when he has murdered his mother. Now, what am I going to do with the Furies? You know, and what I decided to do with them was to make them into an extra form of loneliness and solitude for him. His sister, who has egged him on to do the murder, Electra, she doesn't want him around anymore. His best friend, Leander, who has been leading him from the boarding school place where he's escaped from, he doesn't want him around anymore either. The elders, who are like a jury, have just said, we don't want the boy who murdered his mother near us, coming into the room even, so that he's in his room alone, realizing that nobody actually wants him. So instead of the noise the Furies make, I have the silence of the Furies. I have the sense of them away. I have him further within himself, with no strategy, no plan, and no friends in this place where the world is almost being restored, where it is as though, a city on a hill is being created in some way or other without his presence, even though he's... And the thing I could use most for that, and it didn't occur to me at the beginning, but only as I was working, was the figure of Hamlet. In other words, when he returns to the palace as a young man, he is uneasy and uncertain. His father has been murdered and his mother has taken a lover. And I just go, wow, Shakespeare knew what he was. Shakespeare found so much, as so many writers and translators have, in this story. And that I could make him Hamlet without Hamlet's wit, without Hamlet's ability to change with the weather or say anything he pleased or be immensely eloquent. He's a sort of silent, strange, withdrawn Hamlet who procrastinates too, but misses the point of most things. And and of course, he's a lethal weapon in the hands of his sister, because his sister wants him to do something, as the novel says, she herself will not do, which is murder their mother. He's the one who does it.
It seems, as in reading the novel, that it almost, because of that silence, almost comes off as a happy ending, because there are the question marks left and that silence that allows us to ruminate on that.
Yes, his friend Leander comes up from very early on saying we must kill no more people, there must be no more killing. And when he finds out that the mother has been killed, he said, who said that you could do that? And when he's told, well, the gods have nothing to do with us now. So they're moving into a secular universe. And there's a sense of the elders as, I mean, once in the book they're mentioned as 12 of them, as a sense of the jury, of a sense of a, you know, of a city-state being created with Leander and Electra sort of running it. And then Leander's sister is pregnant. And by the end of the book, she has a baby. She's going to have the baby. And so just as the book is ending, you feel there's a possibility for some new world to begin. However, Aegisthus, the mother's lover, is still alive. And there's one moment towards the end of the book where the little thug within Orestes thinks, oh, look at him. I could kill him too, couldn't I? I mean, why is he still alive? And he looks at his sister and they both sort of nod, meaning as soon as you can, get rid of him. And there's a guard in the last few pages of the book who has betrayed him in various ways. And he says, I'll deal with him later too. So it isn't as though the violence itself is going to fully end, but it has sort of spun out. And I think this is important for now, where we're living in a world, for example, if we think about the Mexican gang killings, or we think about the civil war in Syria, or we think about, say, the troubles that happened in Northern Ireland, the way in which we, in civil conflict, it's very, very difficult to get the genie back in the bottle. It's very difficult to make peace between a warring city or warring factions within the same country. A civil war becomes a much more brutal and intimate war than indeed war between two countries. So I had that in the back of my mind as I was writing the book.
Do you always have something brewing, something that you are working on in a novel sense?
Oh yeah, no, I do. I have too much. I had a friend who was an Irish novelist called John McGahern. That's G-A-H-E-R-N. If you haven't read him, there's a novel called Amongst Women, which is an absolute masterpiece. Mm. But he used to love saying, do you know what I'm hoping for? And I used to always know what he was hoping for. And I would say to him, what are you hoping for? And he would say, I'm hoping not to have another idea until after Christmas. And he could say this early on in the year, like in February or March, so that, every so often something occurs to you. You realize, oh, I'm stuck with this now for the next few years, you know. And I always have a few things on the go and things unfinished and things I need to finish. And
you like that. I mean, it's nice to always have those things there.
But you feel guilty for not finishing them and you feel you should be working harder. And then sometimes a problem arises that you can't solve. And you don't know how to solve. You know, I mean, and the only way you can solve it is just by leaving it alone and the very moment when you least expect it, just when you're walking along the street, or when you're lying in bed, or when you're looking at nothing, ha, the whole thing comes, as though it's been there and you just haven't had the courage to think of it yet. And so it's a funny process because, sometimes the lazier you are, the harder you're working. It's very hard to explain that to your probation officer or something, but it's.
I've talked to many authors who have told me that Hollywood has not been kind to them, but Hollywood has been pretty kind to you, hasn't it?
You see, it wasn't Hollywood. It was a woman came up to me at the Armory Book Fair in New York called Finola Dwyer, who had produced a film called An Education. And she asked me if the rights to Brooklyn were available. And there were sort of almost not at that point. It was almost, we'd almost made an agreement. But I sort of liked her. And her mother had emigrated to New Zealand from Ireland in precisely that year that Ailish Lacey, in my novel, had emigrated. But I realized also that she worked with Nick Hornby. And that team seemed to me an interesting team, based out of London, making independent films. They didn't have a lot of money. And that was important for me because, of course, they weren't buying up rights. I liked her, trusted her. In that second, I liked her and trusted her. I still like her. I still trusted her. But they couldn't get the money at the beginning. If they had got the money at the beginning, Saoirse Ronan was not old enough to play the part. So we would have had to go somewhere else. By the time the money was there, Saoirse was at exactly the right age. And John Crowley, who directed it, was an Irishman from Cork. He was living in London. Saoirse was living in London, away from home for the first time. And, of course, as I said, Finola had her own experience of her mother, and she'd come back from New Zealand to London. So that all of them had a story to tell in this story of mine. And Nick Hornby also, because he's a novelist, he didn't need to compete with me. In other words, he could write his own novel right. if he needed to. What he was trying to do actually was, having read the book, he thought there was something he could do with my book that would work. And so there was never an issue. The marvelous part of the story, I suppose, was that when Nick was writing his screenplay, I did not have an email address for him or a phone number for him. So that if in the middle of the night something occurred to me to say to Nick over something I thought he should do, I had no mechanism to get in touch with him, which was, I think, the way he wanted it. And he was right. In other words, either he writes it or I write it or a committee writes it. If a committee writes it, it's a disaster area. And since I wanted him, the thing to do was to leave him alone. I saw the second draft, which is very close to the final draft, and there were one or two individual words I thought, just because they were about Irish usage, we wouldn't have used that particular word in that year, I don't think. But other than that, I just said, hey, thanks very much. You've done a great job on this. And it'd just be great if someone gives us the money to make it. And we had a lot of fun then because once it opened at Sundance and Fox Searchlight decided to distribute in America, then we were on the road, and it meant that we saw a lot of one another much more. I saw the people who made the film much more afterwards when we were doing publicity. And so I got to know Saoirse very well, and I got to know John Crowley and Nick. So that it was absolutely a great experience, including the Academy Awards, because Nick had written the screenplay, and he's nominated for an Academy Award. So he has a red carpet. He goes in that way. But the way I go in, it doesn't have a red carpet, it has no carpet. And I'm all dressed up. My mother always told me to make sure when you're going out anywhere, always wash under your arms, And so I had washed under my arms. I'd washed the rest of myself as well. And I was fully washed. And I was wearing, a decent suit and all that stuff. But you go in, if you're the novelist, you go in the side door, and I just wanted to say hello to the others, just to say, hi, I'm here, and hey, good luck, or whatever you say to the Oscar people. And I realized it was a man's job, was to push me along and say, you, sir, go inside there, sir, move on, sir. I said, no, I need to talk to my friends. You, sir, move on, sir. And one moment where if I'd reached over a fence, I could have touched Charlotte Rampling on the top of her head. But I thought she didn't want this. So I didn't reach over and touch her on the head. And at one stage, I came back out again to see if I could see the others. And the man saw me meet you, sir, in there, sir.
Colm Tobin has been our guest on this week's book show. His new novel is House of Names. It is published by Scribner. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. This program was recorded at the White Hart Inn in Salisbury, Connecticut, presented by Oblong Books and Music, oblongbooks.com. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.